Hi, and welcome to the Strad podcast. I'm Davina Shum. I'm a cellist and I'm the online editor at the Strad. How do you feel about improvising on a stringed instrument? While there are many musicians who specialise in this craft, you wouldn't have to search far for string players where mention of the words improv and solo is enough to strike fear into their hearts. Violist and composer Jessica Meyer spoke to me about how the word improvisation can be seemingly daunting for string players and how it helps to approach it as making choices instead. She shares her story with incorporating improvisation in her warm-ups and how the mind-body connection of music making inspires her and her students to create their own exercises to further enhance their playing. Here's Jessica. Jessica, welcome to the Strad podcast. We're talking about improvisation in your warm-ups. So tell me a little bit about how you came about using improvisation in your warm-up. Not only are you a violist, but you're also a composer as well. So tell us a little bit about your story.
Well, my story is that I'm from New York and grew up in a very traditional youth orchestra culture. I went to Juilliard for viola, thought I was going to have an orchestra job, kind of like the typical path for a lot of violists. And it turned out that I then became a soloist chamber musician and composer. And most of that is due to my ability to improvise and how that's deeply changed my playing. I was very fortunate in high school to have a jazz bassist be my orchestra teacher. Reynard Burns, wonderful bassist, but also composer. His stuff is out there now. And he would point to us at any given time, and we'd have to stand up and take a solo while playing Turtle Island string quartet arrangements and things. And it wasn't until I got to Juilliard I realized how abnormal that was and how that training is not part of our usual training. I also then spent the next six years at Juilliard with that kind of very tightly affixed perfectionist lid that we then filter everything through as musicians that I then had to slowly pry off after graduation. And the way I slowly pried it off was I did a tour with Savion Glover, the tap dancer. I don't know if you know. And in America, he was a big deal for a while. And we would be playing Shostakovich's eighth string quartet while he tap danced.
Oh, wow.
Bartok Romanian folk dances. And then the whole second half of the show was a big improv. And we would all take solos. And again, my friends who never really do this were like freaking out. And some of them were like, oh, no, it's not so bad. Just take a few notes and let's go. And that was the start of me peeling off the perfectionism that happens, because what happens is that we're filtering everything through a very verbal lens in our minds when we warm up normally. We're constantly already judging as opposed to really feeling and hearing. And I then started to notice that once I regularly stopped the chatter in my brain and just really heard and felt the sound, when I regularly engaged with that, my technique became so much better and natural and didn't get in the way of any physical stresses I was having in my body, but also the mental things. Fast forward 20 years, or 15 years later, when I started writing for myself in Looper, I realized that when I was really deep in my own mind-body connection and just playing sounds I wanted to play to express a certain emotion or thing, I then became a way better viola player.
Yeah.
And so I then started teaching other people to do this, because I think it is so deeply important. And I just got back from a festival in Brazil where the viola players I was working with, you know, there's a certain level of viola playing and they were having a lot of some technical issues. But I just did this workshop where I'm like, let's just take one note, one pitch, and can you just make up something that sounds joyous? Mm-hmm. But just use middle C. And now let's just use three pitches. Okay, well, all right, now you can use five. You're allowed to use five.
Yeah.
You know, all right, well, now you could use any pitch you want, but your enabling constraint is that your idea can only be 16 seconds long.
Just on that, I think what's really important for a lot of classical musicians, a lot of classical string players in particular, to remember is that with improvisation, you can start with with something really simple, right? Like, as you say, just starting on middle C. And I know that for a lot of musicians, the thought of having to get up and do a solo is really daunting because you think you have to replicate something with all the elements. But often it's just picking one or two little aspects to focus on and then just starting from there, right?
And I think people would get stuck on the widescreen version of like, oh my God, and get overwhelmed. But it's like, no. We're all just hanging out in this D minor, A minor land. So just really, as long as you pick a natural note with the occasional B flat somewhere, we're good. You know,
a bit more manageable in that sense, doesn't it? It's like, you don't need to recreate all of this. Just stick to something that you know.
It's just like meditation. Mm-hmm. Like if you're really in the zone and you're present, you're just really reacting to the moment in front of you. And the same thing about improvisation. And like when you really have this mind-body connection with yourself, you're hearing the sound you want to make just before you make it. And wouldn't it be great if all classical musicians can get to that moment? Because then when you're playing Mozart or something really hard, you're still really present. That's my point of like doing these very simple warm-ups to get to the point where, like, so these kids in Brazil, their technique, you know, wasn't always so facile. But wow, I sent them in the corner and I'm like, okay, you're going to make a piece about, you know, a certain emotion. And then they're doing these crazy riffs all up on the C string. Like, it's no problem because they were trying to express a certain thing.
Yeah. Then and, that way their technique is less inhibited because they're just trying to portray a particular emotion or a story that they're trying to tell. A lot of what you say reminds me of a conversation that I had very recently with another podcast guest called Rachel Cooper, and she talks about 3D learning. So really emphasizing it's not just about how something looks. Like, for example, if you're teaching a kid how to hold the bow, it's not just about how it looks, but it's how it sounds, how it feels, and just making sure that you're really focusing in the moment and listening to yourself so that you've got so many different access points to learning a particular concept. I like what you said also about meditation and listening to yourself, you know, that mind-body connection. And I think what it reminds me of is, so for example, this afternoon I've got a physio appointment and my physio likes to encourage me to make up my own exercises because that way I have to really engage with how my body is feeling and think about what exercises are going to feel good for this particular part of rehabilitation that I'm going through. So, you know, tell me a little bit about how you can use improvisation to come up with your own exercises, you know, your own etudes for addressing particular aspects of your music making, because it's quite similar in that way that you've got to really kind of address your own playing rather than doing something that's already prescribed for you.
Absolutely. I was commissioned to write a series of etudes for Juilliard Pre-College, which are on my website. And one of them, I have this choose your own adventure, where you're going with something I've written for you. And then you'll get to this measure where I just put the rhythms and you have to make up your own notes. And that's sort of like a little training wheel that I can kind of give you to start your own. I feel like everybody should be writing their own etudes. I feel like everybody should be able to look at whatever piece they're doing and diagnose it and say, what technique is the tricky thing here? How can I create a short little exercise that gets me in the mood to, or gets me balanced and really connected to my body so that when I play that, it's going to be easier. You know, I think of like Walton, you know, our first page of the Walton Viola Concerto is like a sixth nightmare, you know? I mean, it's just, it's such a mental exercise not to fall off the wagon. But if I'm just playing these chords that are juicy and I love, like, can you go on your viola and find these consecutive sixths and thirds that you like, put them in order of the day, and it should change every day. Play around with them, but play, again, you're playing around with them because you're playing A, what you like. What are your favorite things? When I compose, I'm like, what are my favorite sounds about this to express this thing? Mm. Same thing. What are my favorite sounds about six? What do I love about these chords? How do they make my instrument resonate in a way that makes me so appreciative of why I still play this instrument? You know? And then when you go to Wall and you're like, oh, well, this guy just arranged them in different orders. And he was also expressing this complete, like, unrequited love story with this woman who lived in the house he was writing it in. You know, I mean, like, you know, how can we come up with these little exercises to ourselves just to make it less daunting? And improvisation is such a big word that scares too many people in our classical world. I just love saying, hey, we're just going to make choices about sound.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're making choices. Yeah. I'm making choices about sound to express a certain thing. I use that kind of self-talk for me when I'm composing too. Or when I have a deadline, I'm like, no. I don't have to write this part of the piece today. I'm just making choices about sound and I'm going to have fun doing it. Darn it.
Because it makes it also sound like, you know, if you were making choices, then you were active in that process rather than seeing, say, dots on a page. Obviously, we do need the dots on the page a lot of the time. But then just thinking, okay, what does the composer want me to do and how can I replicate? How can I create this? You know, for a lot of people, it becomes a bit of like you're producing a carbon copy of what's gone before.
Well, this is the issue. I feel like me as a composer, when I have a piece out there and I have a friend, Amanda Gookin, that plays my piece Swerve, and she plays it differently than I perform it, but she owns it. She owns that version of her interpretation of it. And I love that. Mm. I would much prefer that than having just someone do a carbon copy of what I tend to do when I play a piece of mine, you know, and I think we have to remind ourselves that our creative capacity as classical musicians are our interpretiveness. Somehow we've gotten into this belief that we have to go down this lineage of playing Bach a certain way, a piece a certain way, with this technique a certain way. But that takes all the individuality of what being a performer means, and that there's an interpretation. Like, sure, when I prepare a score, I'm writing everything on there that I would like to tell the musicians of what I intended. But then the last part of it is what you do with it. Mm. And I think that in doing warm-ups like playing open strings in the morning and singing intervals with it so that you get your mind-body connection going, putting on a drone and then playing intervals with the drone, just making up some a phrase to express something particular, giving yourself these little exercises of a 30-second character piece, teaming up with the friend of, like, you know, even if you don't live in the same place. I was teaching someone in California and we would just make up these duets on Zoom, you know?
Yeah,
it was actually quite cool. It worked. Again, in Brazil, I saw these amazing, amazing Latin jazz musicians that you could tell there's no words in their mind at all. They're literally communicating with this ESP of joy and virtuosity like I've never seen before. But they're not using this sort of like self-critical or strategizing way that we tend or we were taught to play music in this constant assessment of our technique.
Yes, there is so much emphasis on making sure that your fingers are falling in the right place, making sure that everything looks okay, and a lot of emphasis on the technique. And we do need the technique, but I think a lot of it is to do with trusting yourself.
Yes.
Trusting that you do have the tools at your disposal and finding a new way to listen to yourself, trust yourself to create more output that's not just what's gone before.
Yes. And I feel like that's why I'm starting to really notice that part of my pedagogy is that there's a technical practice and then like, okay, now I'm going to make music. And sometimes those need to be different because technical practice, often when something goes wrong, it's because your hand is not balanced usually in the right way, or you didn't quite get there enough to bring your arm around so that your fingers can just drop and make it easy.
Yeah.
That you haven't released enough weight in your bow arm so that you can pull that great sound because we haven't done enough slow, isolated practice in chunks so that you're giving the signals to your body because you're programming your body when you're learning a piece of music. Mm-hmm. And just like our mind is programmed, like in all of our early interactions and relationships, you know. So it's like when you learn a piece of music from the beginning, we got to do it. There's a certain amount of things to do the technique, but then there's the visualization of how you want the piece to go. And in your mind, part of that is like, how do you want it to sound? And you're using your creative mind when you do that. So, you know, to go from that macro to the micro is these little exercises that you, it's a muscle you're using every day just to make something up. You're making choices about sound and you get used to it so much that essentially when you're playing someone else's music, you're making choices about sound on the fly.
Yeah.
To best express what you think it is, and you're keeping it fresh that way. And you're making it so immediate with your body in a way that's so different than, again, I think how we're usually trained.
Yeah. So I thought maybe to wrap things up, I would like for you to set a challenge for people who are listening today. So for anyone who's listening to this episode and perhaps you're a little bit tentative with using improvisation in your warm-ups, Jessica, could you set a challenge for our listeners?
Yeah, just think about what you can do with just one pitch, you know, and work up to five and just set an intention, decide your mood of the day. You know, maybe you had a rough night the night before, you know, or you're really sad about something, and like put it, transmute that into your music. We're here to transmute different feelings through sound. We keep forgetting about that. That's why audiences keep coming back to hear us, because something was so beautiful or something was so sad or something reminded them of this really hard time that then they were able to use it as a cathartic moment to feel better. So I would start small. Start with one pitch, three pitch, five pitches, go to 30 seconds. Wow, if you did that every day for 30 days... you'd be like a different person.
Yeah, it's a marathon, not a sprint, right?
That's right. It's we're playing the long game here.
Yeah.
So
fantastic. Hopefully people will come away from this episode and have a go at your challenge, and would love to hear from people if they're deciding to go down this route. Jessica, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts today.
Thank you so much. It was an honor being here.
That was Jessica Meyer. Do let us know if you're taking up Jessica's challenge of exploring just one note in your warm-up. I had a go the other day when I was in the theatre, and it's incredible how nuanced just one note can be. So right now you're listening to Jessica's composition from her song cycle Space in Chains, the last movement of which is called O Elegant Giant. Jessica's new composer-performer portrait album, I Long and Seek After, will be released on the 22nd of March on New Focus Recordings. And don't forget to check out thestrad.com. You'll find the latest news, articles, and reviews on all things to do with string playing. If you like what you see and hear, register and subscribe to access exclusive archival content from 2010 onward. There's 50% off an online subscription for students, and if you're not sure you're ready to subscribe, take out a free trial for 7 days, start reading right away with no strings attached. And if you happen to be on Apple Podcasts right now, give us a little review or a rating. It will help other people discover this podcast. Thank you for listening, and tune in again soon for another episode. Take good care. Bye.